Hello and welcome to another episode of The Capitol Record. I am your host, David Bonson. I, in my free time, like to run a little company called The Bonson Group, and in my other free time, do things like host The Capitol Record towards the advancement of a free and virtuous society. I am very, very happy to have as our guest today someone who shares in the aim of a defense of free enterprise, who has written an outstanding new book that I think just does a wonderful job at communicating what markets really are and making the case for the wonderment of free enterprise. He is not only a great writer, a great communicator, he also serves as an associate editor at the Wall Street Journal. And now, in addition to his fine work at that fine paper, has decided to bless us with his new book, which is, by the way, called Visible Hand, A Wealth of Notions on the Miracle of the Market. Visible Hand, A Wealth of Notions on the Miracle of the Market. Obviously, you get the play there, Wealth of Nations from Adam Smith, and Invisible Hand. And we're going to explain in our conversation what the title, what the concept about the book is. But please allow me to welcome to the Capitol Record first-time guest, Matthew Hennessy. So with that said, allow me to welcome to the Capitol Record for the very first time, and I sure hope not the last time, Matthew Hennessy. Matthew, welcome to Capitol Record.
Thank you. I'm very, very happy to be here.
So I just recently finished reading your brand new book, the book we're primarily here to discuss today. And I want to spend not only a fair amount of time allowing you to kind of tell listeners what the thesis of the book is and why you wrote it and all those good things, but I want to start off with a question that I've been meaning to ask you since we first emailed back and forth to set up this podcast. Tell me why you go to kind of conscious effort in the book and in your correspondence with me to clarify that you are not an economist. What is the point you're trying to make there in highlighting your non-economist bona fides?
Because my whole strategy of life is to underpromise and overdeliver. Because I'm conscious of the way any normal person should be of the things I don't know. And I don't want to give the impression to people, in any field, you're going to have people who are experts who resent the infiltration of amateurs, you know. My job is to edit words. I'm a words man. You know, sometimes I joke with my kids around the house. The only thing I know how to fix is sentences. So don't ask me to, you know, stick my head under the hood of the car or something like that. Having said that, I have a great interest in human behavior, and I always have, even before I was an editor at the Wall Street Journal opinion page. And so my interest in human behavior would naturally bring me to this, you know, a sort of the study of economics. Now, I have I don't have a PhD in economics. And so for some people that immediately rules you out of the discussion. So I would just, I like to be as transparent as possible with everyone, so that they know what to expect. I'm going to give them words. I'm going to give them stories. I'm going to give them a lot of laughs and some good sentences. And along the way, we're going to talk about some economics.
It seems to me that in your humility and graciousness and trying to set expectations where you think they should be set, that you also kind of highlight, even if it's not on purpose, a point about many in the economics profession. I suppose by the standard you're setting, people in the economics profession are okay to let you in on the fact that they work in economics, but where you're trying to make the point that you as an editor and engaged in the writing of the English language as you are may not necessarily be concerned with academic economics. But those who are seem to me to be guilty of the thing you're trying to avoid in a different way, which is, I think the economics profession seems to have adopted a belief that they can do more than they could do. And just as you're seeking to avoid giving that impression, when you write a book, as you've written, you don't want it to claim it is solving for more things than it is. But do you think that there is a sense in which with the high role we have for the Federal Reserve in our economy, the high stature we give to the great MIT and Harvard PhD class, the role of economists in political disputes today in trying to validate, put a sort of good housekeeping seal of approval on different policy decisions and whatnot. Has the economics profession gotten a little too big for its britches?
Well, it may have. You know, I think economists or, you know, professional academic economists, the kinds that you see on TV or that you see quoted in front page stories, I think, you know, one of the things you can say about them is they're kind of only as good as what they got right or wrong most recently. So I'm thinking of Larry Summers, who for a while was in bad odor. Now, all of a sudden, everybody's turning to Larry Summers. He's the guy whose name you want to check because he called the inflation thing. You know, that's part of the game. You know, one thing about economics with a big capital E is that for a lot of people, it's a huge turnoff because it's so saturated or appears to be so saturated with numbers. And there's just a certain type of person for whom that just won't work. And so they won't listen to any talk of, you know, supply and demand or trade-offs because they're so frightened of big numbers or all numbers, which to them, you know, smack of math and, you know, love of money. So, you know, I know a lot of people like that. I used to be a person like that. I come from a world where the word economics was just a sort of like, what's that stuff that you put, you know, in the old time movies, they would put over a person's face and it would knock them right out. I can't even remember what chloroform, you know, the word economics was like chloroform. It was like, it would put me to sleep, you know, and I know that it would put my parents to sleep. And if they were asked to sort of define it, it wouldn't have been possible. So there's a huge gap between whatever the brand name MIT or the cutting edge of academic economics is talking about and what regular people are concerned about or can handle. Now, I don't want to imply that people like my parents are not smart enough to get it or whatever, but you know, there's an awful lot of things going on in biology and chemistry at the cutting edge of these fields that, you know, wouldn't translate to the you know, to the sort of the common man, but those, you know, the economy is something that just dominates. You know, it's all we talk about, especially in times like these, in a way that chemistry and biology don't quite control our brains. You know, you don't turn on the NBC nightly news, and you know, occasionally you might see some sort of some drug development news or something that will, you know, hit people in a real way. But for the most part, whatever's going on in the cutting edge of those fields doesn't matter as much to the day in and day out the way economics does, or at least that's the way I see it.
Well, I think it's a really good point. I noticed post financial crisis that there was this real heightened view to what some of the quote unquote economic experts were saying about things, and you can't help but realize that some are sort of expecting and hoping that there's the kind of brainiacs out there that have some sort of solution or magic potion. I suspect the celebrityfication, I made up that word right now, of economists. But I think post-depression, John Maynard Keynes and guys of his ilk, there was a sense of people hoping they kind of had a magic wand and they could sort of policy prescript us out of malaise, out of painful economic times. I don't think people are going to Larry Summers right now merely to pat him on the back for writing an op-ed that got more right than it got wrong a year and a half ago. I think there's sort of an implied expectation that what's your next trick? You know, what can you tell us now that will be predictively beneficial? And yet I think the focus on economics that I gather you take from what I've read of your writing, and that I can assure you I take from what I've devoted my life to, is a humbler view, but I would argue a more exciting view. It doesn't have to be as intellectually intimidating when one chooses to understand economics through the lens of human behavior, human activity, that which incentivizes humans to act or to not act, that these constructs are actually quite identifiable, quite connectable, and I think pretty exciting. So tell us a bit about why you wrote the book and how it connects to the subject of human action.
Well, as I was sort of hinting, I spent a good portion of my life avoiding these kinds of topics. And then in my late 20s, I went back to college. The reasons for that aren't worth going into, but I stumbled into an economics, you know, a sort of a basic microeconomics course without really intending to be there at all, and thinking that it would be a chore. I was really expecting something. I'll be honest with you, David, I was expecting it to be like accounting. I was expecting to be learning how to balance a company's books. And I thought, well, maybe this will be something I can use in my regular life, just to sort of get my financial house in order, you know, one day if I ever have a financial house. But I just fell in love with this stuff. I absolutely fell in love with this stuff, and I had a good teacher, not like a great teacher, not like someone you would put on a pedestal, but just a sort of like a very good basic microeconomics course. And I wanted to stay in that course forever. I wanted to take it over and over and over again. And so, in a weird way, you know, the book is like a love letter to basic microeconomics, in a way, written in a way that I hope appeals to people who don't think that, who like me, think that they wouldn't like economics in any way. So I tried to tell a few stories about my own family's American dream, if you want to put it that way, and to illustrate a few concepts. I have some new ideas about some basic economic concepts that I haven't quite heard articulated in my way before. And finally, I wanted to do a kind of a three cheers for capitalism, because, all you hear all day long is market failures and the kind of the shortcomings of the free market. You hear it from the left and the right. It's sort of like the one thing you can rely on in this life is that someone will have some complaint to make about the economic system that we live over. I make a point in the book not to refer to the free market as a system, but it's very hard to remember. That's sort of the way we talk about it. So the book is a kind of a primer on basic economics with a few chapters that are sort of like hooray for market economics and all the good things that it's done for us. Because as I'm sure you would agree, as I know you agree, we'd be really lost without it.
And so when you talk about the failure of the markets, as you point out, some on the left and the right often we'll look to, do you think part of the problem when one is, I would not argue that people are looking to the failures of the markets too much and not enough to the success of the markets. Although I would agree we don't look to the success of the markets or what you mean by that, the good fruit that comes from the tree of markets. But I wonder if even our understanding of failure of markets is wrong. That what we would call a failure, meaning somebody lost money or there was a bad outcome. I wonder if part of the burden on us is to better define what these things mean, that there's a sense in which we can learn a lot and grow a lot and generate a lot of prosperity and meet a lot of human needs out of what some people call the failures of the markets, that the signals we get from experiments that don't work, the economic calculation we get from overproduction or underproduction, you know, things that could be deemed to be failures. Now, I understand some excesses are worse than others. They're generally governmentally created, it seems. But even when just you and I start a business and it doesn't succeed, I'm hesitant to call that a failure of the market. Do you follow what I'm saying?
I absolutely follow what you're saying. I'm trying to imagine a scenario where the government forces someone to start a business, because I know it happens, but I can't think of it. Yeah, every time that my father had an Irish bar, you know, and within the context of the business, which ended up being very successful, there were an awful lot of failures. You know, it took a long time to get it right, if you know what I'm saying. Like,
yeah.
He was able to scrape together the basic money to buy the place, but every month was a challenge. Every decision about what to put on the menu, or, you know, to swap one beer off the tap for another beer, was like really consequential for him. And sometimes he got it wrong. And I'm sure, you know, I was young, but I'm sure there were times where he thought, I'm making a huge mess here. But the, you know, so within that context, yeah, the market allows for failure as a kind of a mechanism for groping towards better outcomes. You know, that's, you know, if you don't have the possibility of failure, then it's not a risk, you know, and without risk, you don't really have the upside potential of reward. And that's what sort of, you know, that's the engine that makes the whole thing chug. Yeah, I mean, when I say market failure, I'm really just thinking about, you know, the kind of the big ticket items that people blame or lay at the feet of capitalism, you know, like sort of the erosion of the family, or, you know, climate change, the kind of things that it all roads lead back to late stage capitalism, or whatever it is that you know, undergraduate and, you know, perpetual student types would assume is the fault of the free market. You know, when
that,
you
the
know,
market,
often that's
sort
not
of
the
this, I think, what I refer to in teaching it to students, the consumerist myth that markets inherently possess a sort of crass consumerism that reduces everything, all value, to a market transaction, and strips us of a true appreciation for beauty. And I don't think markets do that. And I don't think they do anything close to that. I think that it's a category distinction that strikes me as somewhat easy to differentiate. However, if there is some element of trying to force everything into a sort of materialist construct, or a kind of consumer level identity, it seems to me that the government intervention in prices or the marketplace is probably more guilty of that than anything else. Like, it's an odd critique, because I don't ever know what they're proposing to do about it, other than you know, perhaps making a cultural comment, like, I sure don't like how much kids are on TikTok, or something like that. Like, that's pretty innocuous. I could get around for that. But when it generally is accompanied by some suggestion of central planning, right? Some suggestion of more intervention, it seems to me those solutions exacerbate the problem.
Yeah, well, when you use in terms like materialist constructions and crass consumerism, it's almost, you know, the debate is already, you've already lost, you know. So my goal, or, you know, yeah, is to kind of intervene, if at all possible, before we get to that stage. Yeah. I hate to sort of rely on this, you know, like it used to be. In the old days, it might, you know, you might have imbibed some of this stuff a little more naturally through the atmosphere. But it's rare that, you know, the economy has changed so much that it's rarer than it used to be, perhaps, that people grew up in a home like I did, where, you know, the parents were running a very small business and making a go of it. You know, if you're a kid in high school or in college anymore, you're likely not getting past the crass consumerist stage, where the sort of the, you know, your impression of the economy is that it's just a giant rigged game, and the rich get rich and the poor get poorer. And if that's the sort of the level of analysis that you're talking about, then I'm not sure that you would even be able to appreciate some of the things that you just described. It's sort of like, so what I'm trying to do with the book is to get in there, certainly in my own house, I'm trying to do it. I'm trying to get these ideas into my own kids' heads before they fly the coop and start marinating in some toxic brew of college campus socialism. But hopefully some people, it might be a good stocking stuffer if you've got somebody in your house who's flirting with some bad economic ideas.
Yes, yes. Well, one of the things that you do that I thought would be fun to unpack a little is, similar to the way another writer at your great paper in an earlier life, Jude Winiski, wrote about the way the world works. And you described Adam Smith's writing not to propose a new form of economics, but rather Adam Smith describing economics, writing about the way the world works, so to speak, a couple hundred years before Jude wrote his great book. The Wealth of Nations is not a proposal for a new economic framework, but it is describing what works about this economic framework that we might now look at as a kind of early classical description of laissez-faire economics. Tell us why that distinction is important.
Well, I've always been fascinated by the fact that Wealth of Nations was published in the same year as the Declaration of Independence, right? 1776. Yes. And I think that this has left, it certainly left in my mind, but it may have left in many people's minds the idea that Smith's ideas were new and some sort of revolutionary introduction of a brand new set of ideas that... that notion sort of jives with people's general impression that economics is a kind of an overlay on life, that you have your real life, you have your sort of, your family relations and your personal relations. And then there's this overlay, this sphere of economics that sort of like intrudes on things and makes it harder for you to get the things that you want. And, I just think that's the wrong way of looking at it. I don't think that's, part of the problem is that The Wealth of Nations is a really hard book to read. It's not a very attractive book, certainly to the modern ear, or to the modern eye. It's antiquated, and a lot of the examples are weird, and you get lost in the language, and it's massive. It's a gigantic book. So it's really sort of a big, it might as well have a sticker on it saying, do not read if you're 18. Right. So likely the only thing you're ever going to hear about it is this notion of the invisible hand. But if you dip into it, and certainly the notion of the invisible hand is a good and useful metaphor, and I'm glad that it's out there. But that's not all there is to The Wealth of Nations. In fact, the invisible hand is only mentioned once in The Wealth of Nations. Now, some people have gotten in touch with me recently to let me know that Adam Smith, Adam Smith scholars, to let me know that he used this notion of the invisible hand elsewhere, like in letters and things like that. So I perhaps made too much of it in the book that it's only mentioned once. But the book is very much like a work of reportage. At least that's how I interpret it. It's a kind of I'm not an economic historian either. So for all I know, this is the first, my impression is that this is the first time that anyone sort of brought it together. Adam Smith's great contribution was to sort of to say like, look, this is what you're doing. This is what you are. This is how you behave. This is how you, meaning we, organize our lives, our commercial lives and our social lives and our trading lives. And this is how we pay for stuff. And this is how we produce stuff. And this is why we make investments in ourselves. And you should look at it, because when I look at it, it tells me some things that that would be useful, meaning some ways of producing and consuming and organizing your life are more efficient than other ways of producing and organizing and consuming. And if you study it, you might change some of your behavior. You might make different choices if you're a household or if you're a nation. So I think it's very, I think it's well worth, I wouldn't advise people to try to read it if, you know, if they're not looking for like a, you know, a difficult time, because it's certainly not an easy read. But you know, it's worth reexamining your assumptions about it. Because if you are like me and you came from a background that presumed that economics was a kind of an imposition and a kind of an overlay rather than a sort of, you know, reality rather than just a sort of description of the way things actually are. You know, my big contention in the book, and I don't know if other people have done this, I haven't read it elsewhere, so I like to claim it for myself, but if someone came forward and said, no, people have been talking about this for a long time, you're wrong, I would accept it, is the idea that the laws of economics are not unlike the laws of gravity. They just exist. They're not an invention. They're not they didn't spring from Adam Smith's mind the way, the sort of the socialism that we recognize sprung from the minds of Marx and Engels. The laws of classical liberal economics are entirely natural. And, you know, like the laws of gravity, if you try to resist them or if you try to work against them, you're going to cause a lot of friction and pain and suffering for yourself. So we
think about the basic and most universal laws of economics as the law of supply and demand, the law of marginal utility. Are there other basic laws that speak to scarcity and speak to what we think of as basic economics that are worth reinforcing for their universality and for their existence as laws, not as policy impositions? What are some of the basics here that you think are worth noting in that regard?
Well, the absolute most basic thing and the most essential thing is that life is about trade-offs.
Yeah.
You can't have everything you want. Without that limiting principle, none of it matters. I'm not sure what life would be like if we could have everything we want. It would be different. Let's just put it that way. So life is about trade-offs. And if you don't start there, then you're welcome to be sold, you know, all sorts of utopian promises about
down every economic fallacy trap known to mankind.
Yeah. So the way
what would you think about someone who decided to write a book about the basics of economics and decided to title it "There's No Free Lunch" because they believed that the fundamental law of economics is scarcity and the existence of trade-offs? That would seem like a pretty good book title to me.
Yeah, something you have to be a really handsome guy to write a book like that. I actually love your book. I think it's fantastic. I wish I had had it when I was working on Visible Hand. It would have been a tremendous resource.
Well, and vice versa. We probably could have helped one another.
Well, no, you really could have helped me because, you know, there are times when you're writing, as I'm sure you know, when you're thinking to yourself, I sure could use somebody to back me up on this, you know, some heavy hitter, somebody with a big name. And I just know that, you know, Tom Sowell or Tyler Cowen or Adam Smith or Hayek or somebody must have, you know, they must have said something about this that I'm writing about right now. And it sure would be nice to slot them in here as a kind of attaboy. So your book would have been extremely helpful to me in that regard, just as a cheat sheet.
Yeah,
but it's so wonderful to have all those sort of nuggets in one place, and you know, at the risk of turning this into a something that it's not supposed to be. It's not just a selection of quotations. It's not just sort of like Bartlett's or Bonson's famous quotations or anything like that. It's there's an awful lot of your inscriptions and your contributions are also right on point, and it was great to read.
Well, I appreciate that. I hope that my editorializing in the book's appreciated. I hope the category compartmentalization is useful, and I know there's a lot of tremendous wisdom from the people I'm quoting. You know, there nobody should ever tire of reading Hazlitt and Hayek and the greats. But you're one of the first to bring up what I always did hope would be something that would be an advantage of the book for those reading it is a reference, you know, that like if somebody like yourself who's editorializing in this domain could use the book as a sort of cheat sheet of different things. And I suppose everyone has Google and so forth, but sometimes it's hard to know what you're looking for. And you go, you know, some of these guys too, their most accessible quotes are not even close to their best ones or most substantive ones. You get a certain amount of sloganeering that falls its way into the SEOs. And yet I actually think that when one wants to go by category, and it's a great way, I think, to follow Hazlitt, is to see what Hazlitt had to say by topic. And so whether it's credit or wage controls or, you know, some of those different themes, I'm hoping the book will, you know, be adopted that way as a reference for people who write about such things. People like yourself.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting when you read the people that, you know, that we're talking about here. You know, these are the best writers in the game. You know, these are the five, let's just say, you know, top five Hall of Fame economic writers. And still, you know, if you're going to wade into, you know, the road to serfdom or something, you got to put your thinking cap on. It's not like on every page, there's like a really pithy sort of quotable line you could drag out you know, so it's useful to have someone has sort of done the work. You know, Henry Hazlitt may be a little more accessible than Hayek, but and, you know, Tom Sowell for sure. But some of these books become really, really, you know, they're big, scary books, not unlike The Wealth of Nations. So I don't want to repeat myself, but I'm very grateful that There's No Free Lunch exists, because I'll be using it a lot.
Well, thank you for that. Matthew, one of the things that struck me in your book, and I think might even be why Jack Fowler thought that you and I really ought to connect. I lost my dad a long time ago. I know your dad passed more recently, but it is quite clear that we have a similar affection for our late fathers. I think it would be a disservice to listeners to have you on, talk about your book, talk about your story, and not have you biographically contextualize the book around what you learned from the enterprise of your dad. Maybe tell a little bit of that story.
Yeah, so my dad was, for the first part of his life, you know, not unlike myself, had, you know, didn't really land until he was about, you know, in midlife. He did a lot of work that you would call, you know, that I describe as helping profession work. He was a teacher, never anywhere too long, you know, a couple years here, a couple years there. He did some social work. And then when he was in his late 30s, let's say, he got a good job running a youth shelter in our county where I grew up. I'm not entirely sure how he got this job. You know, he had a college degree and he had some work, but he got it really through connections and through friends and stuff like that. And my dad was a good guy, like a kind of hail fellow, well-met type guy. Everybody loved him. His name was Jim, but his nickname from high school was Hambone. So you can imagine a guy with a nickname like Hambone is going to be a guy that you want, you know, hanging around at the party. But he was good at this job running the youth shelter, but it was a kind of a political job because it was run, you know, the shelter was set up by the county. And at a certain point, some political thing happened and he ended up out on his rear end. Circumstances a little murky, but all that's necessary to know for these purposes is that he didn't have a job and he was looking down the barrel of 50. He had a couple of kids who were teenagers getting ready to go off to college. And it was kind of a desperate moment, a dramatic moment, you know, a scary moment. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that happens in a lot of people's lives. You get to the middle of your life when you're supposed to be in your prime earning years and then something goes upside down. And what are you going to do? So what he was going to do was he had been working nights moonlighting in this bar. And the guy who owned it was, getting ready to sell it. And it was a real, you know, you can imagine this kind of a place. This is northern New Jersey. It was owned by this guy who was the only employee. So he opened when he wanted to open. He opened, you know, the place at, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And if there was something on TV at 10 o'clock that he wanted to get home for, he shut the door and he kicked everybody out. So my dad bought this place, a real small sort of subsistence level. I call it a sticky elbows joint. You know, it was nothing but old men in windbreakers in there watching a little, you know, Yankees baseball on a TV. So this was in about 1983. And I really don't know how he managed to get the money to do this. I think he set up a little deal with the guy, with the outgoing owner, where he would, you know, sort of he bought it on time, if you like. You know, he was still paying the guy for a couple of years after that. For the first few years, he and my mother poured absolutely every ounce of energy they had into the place. You know, when you're your own boss in a place like that, if somebody's sick and can't come in, you got to go in yourself. If there's a plumbing emergency at 11:30 at night, you're the guy. So it was like that for a couple of years. And it was a struggle. I know that they struggled. And my sister was going to college. I can't imagine how they managed to pay for it. Somehow, as if by magic, you know, around 1989 or 90, 91, I was just about to graduate from high school. The place really exploded. They didn't do anything differently. It was still a kind of a sticky elbow joint. It was still an old man joint, but it started attracting a younger crowd and they really started packing them in. And as the 90s, you know, economy kind of heated up, the larger economy heated up, Hennessy's became like a real hot spot in our town. And my parents really, really started to do very, very well. And the reason that I bring it up in the book is because they went from the wolf at the door to, you know, it always sort of makes me a little emotional to think of my parents going on vacation because, you know, my mother was the daughter of immigrants. My father was a Depression kid. You know, the best that they ever really aspired to was like a week at the Jersey Shore or something like that. By the 90s, the mid 90s, they had a few bucks in their pockets and they did it right. They went to all the places they wanted to go and see Hawaii. They went to Ireland a bunch of times. They were in France. You know, it makes me so happy just to think about it. But the important point for my book is that my dad had zero business training. So he had never taken any kind of a course in meeting payroll or ordering inventory or, you know, accounting, balancing the books, paying your taxes a couple times a year, the way you have to do when you're a small business. All he had ever known was Hambone. All he had going for him was that he was the life of the party and that he was, you know, willing to work as hard as he needed to make a success of the place. And so, you know, my contention is that in a free market, somebody with those qualifications and that work ethic is going to make a success of themselves eventually. As you pointed out at the beginning, you know, you're going to have some setbacks. Some ventures aren't going to succeed. You're going to have to, you know, burn through some sweat equity or some capital sometimes to make it work. But the odds are in your favor if you bring what my dad brought to the party, even if you are absolutely a novice at the things of business, because, you know, in a way, I think the market wants you to succeed. It wants to surface ambition and reward it. It wants to surface hard work and reward it. It wants to surface new ideas and new ways, innovative approaches to problem solving, to get the best out of people. So Hennessy's, which was the name of the place, you know, as I emphasize in the book, it was not just a place for my parents to go to work every day. It was that, and it paid for those vacations I'm talking about. It paid to send my sisters and my brother to college, and it paid for our house. But it was also something else. It was like a community hub. It was a center of a wheel with spokes reaching out to other local businesses, big and small. It kept a kind of local economic river flowing right through the front door and right out the back door. Just, you got to pay your suppliers. You got to pay your employer, your employees. You have to, do all the things that a small businessman do. Those people go out, they pay their mortgage. They send their kids to school. They shop in the local, right? It's all that kind of what I call hand-to-hand commerce that makes a small, a local economy, that makes a town. But I don't see any difference between that necessarily and what General Motors does. I think it's just a matter of scale. So Hennessy's exists in the town. Well, it doesn't exist anymore, but it existed where it existed in the time and place. It served an economic purpose. It put some cabbage in my parents' pockets, but it also sort of lifted all the boats that it came into contact with. And so it's a kind of an American success story that gave me an opportunity to explore a bunch of different things that I don't think are explored as often as we might think they are anymore in our culture. Like, you know, you hear politicians lauding small business owners and this kind of thing during political season. But it used to be that the guy that stood up a solid small business in a town was considered a kind of a pillar of the community, you know. And now I get the sense, well, maybe I'm being too harsh, but I am being too harsh, because if my dad were here today, I don't think you could have denied, you know, he could have made a success in any of these areas. But the power of the ham bone was, you know, his centripetal force was pretty strong. But so that's the story of my parents. That's the story of Hennessy's. And I think it's, you know, it's the kind of story that, this is a big country with people now making business successes out of their living rooms through the internet. All the way on up to whatever Elon Musk is doing with Tesla. These stories are I think that's the main thing that I like to tell a story like this, because I think people can relate to it. You know what I mean? I'm not sure how many people can relate to what Elon Musk is doing, or, Amazon is an interesting company, because I think that everyone sort of, because they deliver things right to your front door, it feels very much like a local business. And I think that people can really understand somehow intuitively what that business entails, even if they don't know how complicated it is for Amazon to source all the things that it sources, or to, you know, I know that Amazon has been accused of stealing people's designs and copying things, but it's a large and complex enterprise. But it feels very intimate, and it feels not unlike calling up my dad and saying, hey, can you deliver me, you know, a hamburger or something like that? So, I think the big businesses get a lot of the attention, and the small businesses, often you don't hear much about them until somebody who's running for governor comes to town.
Well, I think you're exactly right. Honestly, I think the whole entire story is about as perfect an encapsulation of what I believe about markets, of what I want to accomplish with this podcast, but with all my attempts at messaging what markets are. I think when you talk about the story of Hennessy's, and that it, you know, what happens at General Motors is different with scale, but other than that, the attempt to have these engines of markets and pursuit of rational decision making and working hard and markets rewarding, you know, hard work and good decisions. That distinction between micro and macro, I really think, is nothing more than what you said. That is scale. But that the principles do not change, that you don't have X is good for micro and bad for macro, or vice versa. You just simply attach scale to two different things, and I guess we call that difference micro and macro. But I don't feel that qualitatively that the story of markets is more profoundly beautiful with Tesla or GM than I do with Hennessy's. It touched more people. There's more vendors, more employees. In some cases, more wealth destruction, like in the failure of GM in 08, and in some cases, more wealth creation, like in the story of Tesla. But I think that the principles and the behaviors and the attributes that we're talking about are the same. And I think that your book has got to be read by people who are interested in understanding this in all its majesty, that micro and macroeconomics are, in fact, the story of people like your dad. And I can't thank you enough for writing it. I hope that the message gets out there far and wide. I will tell you, if we didn't share the loss of father and the loss of a father who we happen to like and a care for markets and a similar belief system about much of what we're expressing in our understanding of markets, just your willingness to go hammer Murray Rothbard made it worth the cost of the book for me. So thank you for about 8 different things.
Okay. Well, you're welcome for all those things. I mean, as I was just listening to you talk about Tesla and Hennessy's, and all I keep thinking is that, you know, if you strip it all away, if you strip away the doors that open up rather than out, or you know, the whole climate component of an electric car, or the batteries and China and sourcing the rare earth elements, and if you strip all that out, you know, Elon Musk is not going to succeed if he can't give people something that they, if he can't satisfy people's needs, if he can't give them something that they want and need. And the same principle applied to my dad. It really was the same job. I need to give people something that they need at a price that they're willing to pay so that they go home happy and I go home happy. It's win-win. It's a mutual victory, because if anybody's unhappy, then they're free to walk away, right? I am free not to buy a Tesla. Even if I could afford it, I'm free to not buy it, right? That's what a free market is. It's a way for people to satisfy each other's needs, so that everybody goes home happy. So that, you know, my dad, if you think about it, is just as much of a important figure as Elon Musk.
Well, I most certainly agree. I cannot commend the book enough. I appreciate you not only writing the book and the great work you do at the Wall Street Journal, but of course, I appreciate you joining us here at the Capitol Record. And I would really love it if you'd come back again.
Okay, David, thanks.
Well, thanks once again for listening to Capitol Record. I hope you enjoyed Matthew's contributions. I hope you will pick up his new book. I truly do believe it's one of the great books I've read. Very simple and easy read, but compelling and provocative. Gives you a lot to contemplate and just allows you to take home a more practical and working appreciation of the miracle of markets. If it weren't for the miracle of markets, we wouldn't have this podcast. We wouldn't be motivated to carry the message of what capacity exists in the human spirit to do great things, evidenced in the case of someone like Matthew's father, and evidenced in the entire advancement to civilization that we've seen through the miracle of free enterprise. Thank you, as always, for listening to the Capitol Record. We'll be back to you next week.